I'm gonna haul off and slap me.
I'm not gonna haul off and slap you.
And then have a fit of space tuberculosis?
No. Oh, shit, I want a drink.
You should get some more whiskey. Starward for Gunbuster. That's what I'm gonna do. Oh. Paul went to get a drink because we have the privilege of living in the delivery area of two really good wine and liquor stores. So today I finally got another bottle of whiskey, which we've been out of. I have wine. I'm good on all my shit. But I got Paul this Australian whiskey. The brand is Starward. And the label is really cool. It's very appropriate for watching Gunbuster. I think I got the one that isn't the single malt because it's less expensive. So yeah, this is my Spawn Con that isn't actually Spawn. Man. And I'm drinking a Cannonau, which I didn't know about until Paul told me about it. I just did SpawnCon that the whiskey company didn't ask me for about the whiskey you're drinking.
For Starward Australian whiskey?
Yeah.
Yes. Also, you can't put your drink on the table here. It'll make it clunk.
Okay. I'm sorry. Sorry for party clunking. Also, sorry that that's what came into my head just now. Our cat just got in the box that we keep our podcast equipment in.
He looks like he's settling in, though, so maybe he's not going to be a horrible pest. Welcome to Active Heart episode number 5.
Please, time enough for love.
The penultimate episode. I just like using penultimate correctly. Because I used it incorrectly once to mean ultimate, and my father corrected me, and I was like at peak being annoyed that you're... Not being annoyed. At peak being embarrassed that you were wrong about trying to say something precocious, and I was extremely embarrassed.
My little kid thing... One of my little kid things was, like, I didn't know how to pronounce pseudo-intellectual, which is a really funny word to mispronounce.
It's extremely...
I thought it was pseudo-intellectual.
Pseudo-intellectual. That's when you're really smart about suede.
Maybe it's like a fashionable...
These are actually cerulean suede shoes. God, I couldn't nail the joke. It's fucked. I'm going to cut this all out.
No, I think we should just go... We should wild out.
We should wild out?
Yeah. So everyone, okay, I'm not going to compare anything to the very end of Gunbuster.
So what I had forgotten about...
You just interrupted me.
I just cold interrupted you. There is so much nudity in this episode.
And...
No, not even nudity. There's so much, like, casual, like... I didn't want to say fan service, but just like girls in skimpy outfits.
I was planning on talking about it.
Oh, we're going to get to that. I'm sorry. I just, it really stuck out to me. Molly... Please.
I don't want to compare any moment in this show to the very end. Like, I think that stands on its own in fiction in general.
I would agree.
So if you don't count that, this is probably my favorite episode.
Okay.
I'm sorry if I, like, I can't promise that I won't tear up a bit when we talk about the end of this episode. So just brace yourselves.
It's a good episode.
It's weird, too.
It's weird. It's strangely for a show that's been all about really kind of rough, bittersweet moments. This one feels like it kind of takes it to another level. As in previous episodes, there's a lot of kind of slice of life, character establishing, emotional build up before the action climax of this show. And it opens with like a really like the first of a series of extremely affecting and poignant scenes.
And there again, there's no OP.
Yeah, it's another cold open, and it colds open on Noriko and Takaya.
Cold open.
Very good. Noriko and Takaya having a graduation ceremony for two. Like, they have returned, and they are now graduating from the high school that they never really attended. Because they are still high school age, and they are graduating. But while they've been out on the Excellion, the 10 years has passed on Earth.
Yeah.
So they've been gone for a few months, and 10 years has passed on Earth.
And it's really quietly devastating, because it's a high school graduation ceremony that's like all the meaning for them, and it's just been like sucked out of it.
Right. They're like, and it's a full ceremony. Like, there's, it's held in the, so Japanese graduation ceremonies are very stately affairs, and they are held almost without exception in the school's gymnasium, as is this one. And they all have the same kind of staging and setup. And normally the entire student body of the school, all 3 years of high school, gathers for the graduation ceremony. But their graduating class is kind of scattered. You know, many of them are dead, probably.
Why do you think that?
Because they were, many of them were on the ship. Like,
on the Excellion?
Yeah. And not like everyone is on the ship, but like they had fellow students who were combatants in the battle. I think it's reasonable to imagine that not all of them survived. Or do you think that they were the only two from their class? I think
that they were the only two from that school that went to the Excellion.
Maybe you're right. Well, okay. So taking a step back, maybe none of their classmates have been KIA.
But they are scattered.
They are scattered because it's been 10 years and most of them have aged 10 years in that time. So they have like a special graduation ceremony for Noriko and Amano, who are just like, I said Noriko and Takaya are there. That's like, that's her two names, Noriko and Amano. And it's like the whole faculty, and they're all kind of old, because they clearly like brought in all the faculty from the school years they went to, and then they like do the roll call, except for the roll is just those two students, and they come up and accept their diplomas. And it's like this weirdly affecting but also empty thing as they comment after the ceremony.
And Noriko actually, she, you know, graduates from high school at 17, even though kind of she should be 27.
Right. Like,
she kind of makes a joke about how, like, well, I guess I should feel special for graduating high school at 17. And another reason that this graduation ceremony is so weird is it emphasizes how Noriko and Amano are part of something that nobody else around them can understand, because they're not from the same graduating class in Earth years.
Right.
In, you know, a peaceful world, they would not have graduated high school together.
Aren't they?
Noriko is a year younger.
You think?
Yes.
All right.
They flash a picture of Noriko's graduating class, and that's also really sad, because yeah, it's the group graduation picture that was taken, you know, on the actual graduation day, and they've sort of just like pasted Noriko's portrait like in the corner.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's rough. And Noriko, as she often does, is kind of laughing it off, like, haha, I guess I'm like technically 27 now. Maybe I should have a kid. And right that moment, they happen to walk past Noriko's old school chum, Kimiko, who is now 27 and is like out walking her toddler aged daughter. And they do kind of a double take, and then each of them recognizes the other, and Amano leaves them to kind of catch up, and Amano goes off on her own, and Noriko and Kimiko have this kind of interesting conversation.
And when Kimiko realizes it, she's formal at first.
Yeah.
She's like, Takaya Noriko-san?
Yes. Are you possibly Miss Noriko Takaya?
Then they're in, they go to the playground and Kimiko's daughter is 3. And they catch up and it's pretty, their rapport is still pretty natural, still pretty there.
Although I think it's a really great performance by the voice actress of Kimiko yeah. who like has just like a totally different register for her voice. She doesn't sound like a high schooler anymore. She sounds like an adult woman with a child, even though, I mean, she's still in her 20s. Like, she's not that old, but she sounds... She's radiating the signifiers of adult perspective in a way that Noriko still doesn't really.
And her demeanor is completely different.
Totally different.
As you guess it would be. But then they also show the school bully from episode 1, Kashiwara, has become like a hard-ass teacher.
Oh yeah, she's like this hard femme, like sort of coach descendant with like, you know, her white t-shirt kind of rolled up around her midriff and like a cocky smirk on her face, just a real badass.
So that's
kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, that goes to show you that there are characters that mature and their entire demeanor doesn't change. And I think one of the reasons that this scene with Kimiko is so sad is that she has a lot of reasons why she's changed completely.
Yeah.
Noriko and Amano went through extremely traumatic things in space, but it isn't until this scene, I don't think, that Noriko realizes how like weird and hard life has been for people on Earth.
Right.
And how they live in this constant like doomsday.
Right. Like, you haven't really thought about it because we've only gotten the military perspective on the space monster threat. But in this scene with Kimiko, we get the civilian perspective. And what's more, the civilian perspective removed from time dilation. So Noriko's had this like very eventful but relatively brief military career, whereas everybody on Earth has just been kind of sitting, living their lives, waiting to see if like an enormous fleet of space monsters is going to show up and kill them all. And they're just not going to know which way it panned out for a few years because of time dilation.
I think it's dawning on me now that Kimiko's attitude in this scene is kind of the most similar to us. We humans living in the year 2020.
Yes.
And they're back in Okinawa and they see, is it that you can see kind of a shadow in the sky?
No, you can see the reflection of the Eltrium from the ground at night. Kind of like you can see the International Space Station from Earth on a clear sky if you know where to look and you're there at the right time. It's very visible. If you look at it with binoculars, you can actually make out the shape of the space station. So, and the Eltrium is a new battleship that's under construction. It's 70 kilometers long and you can see it from Earth, and they look up and have a conversation about the Eltrium as it passes overhead.
And it's also an evacuation ship, correct?
Yeah, apparently it's going to accommodate a limited number of civilians in kind of a last ditch. In case of an evacuation, it will be used to evacuate some very small
4,000-1 odds of getting on
some very small ship. Population from Earth.
And this is where,
go ahead.
Like, really tragically, Kimiko looks at Noriko with these really like world-weary eyes for a 27-year-old.
Yeah.
Says, you know, if that happens, like, please use your connections to get my daughter a space on this ship.
Right. And you get a sense that, like, I mean, you know, because I haven't done a podcast about this show before, and I also haven't watched it as a old man in the year of coronavirus, it never occurred to me how weird it must have been for Kimiko to get pregnant and have a kid during the threat of the Earth being destroyed by space monsters.
Yeah. And it's some
like more... she's been living with this dread every day of her life for the past 3 or 4 years.
It's like a sci-fi, extremely drawn out version of what we're going through.
Yeah.
Where at some point they live in constant fear, but it's like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, like...
just stop your life.
Are you going to just stop living?
I mean, we should stop living to some extent, but...
Well, you know, the novel Coronavirus is not space monsters. It's not the same thing. Space monsters will not be addressed by... Okay, well, I had a thing I was going to say, but now I just want to say, BASTA! SOCIAL DISTANCING!
Oh my god.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Kimiko is very sad. It's a very sad scene.
She's very sad, but she's also, like, really composed. I mean, this is clearly a thing that people in her generation have had to think about.
Yes. And you have to wonder, like, how often she's thought about Kimiko, or I'm sorry, how often she's thought about Noriko, and how is this like a, I mean, clearly their encounter was a spur of the moment, coincidence, but does she ask her because it has occurred to her, man, if I could just have a conversation with my old high school friend Noriko, I might be able to make sure that my daughter has some kind of a chance at a life if things get really bad.
Yeah.
I mean, she must have thought of that ahead of time. Like, because who wouldn't?
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, man, she has powerful Hitozuma energy. Just a really hot housewife. I'm sorry.
She had a glow up.
She did have a glow up. She's very pretty.
And this makes me think, like, you know, Paul and I have spent many a time speculating on the adult futures of the Dear Brother character. So it's like, is this what adult Tomoko would be like?
No, and I'll tell you why not. Because I am not a everybody's a lesbian, everybody's gay future person. Although, Dear Brother, I think more or less. Listen, okay. So we might have to do a Dear Brother podcast after this.
Yeah.
Nanako, probably bi, right? But I get like very gay energy off of Tomoko in Dear Brother. I don't think she would, I don't think Tomoko would be like a sort of understatedly, sensuously feminine woman in her late 20s. I think she
No,
would,
that's like what Nanako is going to be.
That's what Nanako is going to be, but Tomoko is going to be much sportier and butcher, for lack of a better term, I think.
I'm going to curtail this conversation quickly after this, but yeah, I think basically Tomoko takes up the mantle of like Kaoru no Kimi and becomes
right, like
the butch girl that all the underclassmen are in love with.
Yes, clearly. She's also the like only sensible person in the show. So, okay.
Watch Dear Brother.
Yes, watch Dear Brother. It's good. Moving right along.
To Noriko's room. We've been in this room once before in episode one. It's still messy, but in a different...
Oh, no. I have to say one more thing about the Eltrium. No, I've been looking forward to this the entire show. I've been waiting for this shot. So we cut when Kimiko is talking about the Eltrium. She looks up to space, and then we see a shot, like, close up on the Eltrium of it being constructed in orbit. And the construction scaffolding around its, like, orbital construction equipment is very clearly, like, the same plastic flash that plastic models come in before you build them, that you have to, like, twist them off of.
Mm.
Like, it's it's a clear reference to like nerds building models, like Gundam models and spaceship models and fighter jet models. Like it's obviously that.
Just military grade Gunpla.
Yeah, exactly. And I find that very funny and cute.
That is cute.
Okay, I'm sorry. Now, Noriko's room.
Noriko's room is messy, but in a different way than it was when she was in high school. She has a bunch of unpacked boxes with the insignia of the Excelion on them. She has laundry hanging up. And pretty much the only other thing in her room is some Ghibli posters.
Yeah, she has a Totoro poster and a Nausicaa poster.
And they're not even like, you know, whack Donalds. It's just...
No, it's just the posters for those movies.
I mean, they're buds. Anno and Miyazaki.
So. Anno worked on Nausicaa. I'm almost positive.
But yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
But it makes me wonder, like, was like Totoro in the year it came out, like a canonical part of the Gunbuster universe where this is, you know, a 40-year-old classic family movie that people in 2020, 2030 are fans of.
Interesting. I don't know.
I would like to think so.
I mean, Totoro was an instant classic. And it came out in 88. Like, it was coming out right as Gunbuster was coming out. Whereas Nausicaa came out in 84.
Yeah, but I like to think that this is like an AU where they continue to be classics.
Why wouldn't? I mean, but they did. They are. Like,
I'm not getting my point across. Sorry.
I don't.
I'm talking like macro shit. Like the movie is canonically a movie in the universe, kind of thing.
Wait. So, but I don't understand.
Okay, people watching Gunbuster would have been fans of like Totoro, and Nausicaa. So it's like a cute reference in that way.
Yes.
I'm saying I like to read these posters as not just like a fun reference for the people watching, but the idea that in an alternate 2030,
yes,
they would still be beloved family.
Oh, yeah, no, I read them as Nausicaa and Totoro were movies in the universe of Gunbuster, and Noriko is a fan of them. That's how I read this.
Sorry.
Yes, I agree with you.
And it's also a nice little visual reminder that these are the posters she had up when she was in high school.
Oh, yeah, it is.
And now we have to talk about Noriko's boobs.
Molly, I leave this to you.
So Gunbuster is I mean, I haven't been in these conversations. I can only imagine it's sort of a legendary fan service show.
It is.
Not in that it's like an ecchi show, but that when it goes into fan service, it does it really well. It goes really hard.
And by fan service, if you're not in the community, we mean gratuitous nudity.
If you're not in the community, you're fucked. You had to listen to us talk about Dear Brother for like 3 minutes.
Yeah, but we weren't using strange terminology then. No. It's fine.
But in this scene, this is the scene that really solidified that I, as a person who like can be sensitive to fan service, I do bristle when I feel like a show is giving me the visual message of like, this isn't made for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't get that from Gunbuster.
And by you mean this isn't made for you, a woman.
Yeah.
Right.
And I don't get that from Gunbuster. And this is always the scene I think of, because Noriko's wearing like panties and a loose tank top and flopping around on her bed on the phone.
Right.
And like her tits just kind of fall out of her tank top.
Right.
I'm sorry. In exactly the way mine do.
Sure.
When I'm wearing a version of that outfit, which is basically what I sleep in.
Sure.
So I don't know. I was just really charmed by, like, this is what breasts actually look like. This is what, like, a girl alone
would wear
and, like, feel okay with her body. It's not that bullshit, like, anime girl doing something with her boobs in private that, like, no one would actually do.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, the people who made this are horny, but they also cared enough to make it
like they cared natural. Enough about the characters, like, personality and experience and the setting of it. They didn't just put her in a whatever. And I mean, like, counterpoint, the Gunbuster uniforms, like,
whatever, I like them.
It's great that you like, but like, you know, there's only so far you can take this argument, but I do think there's something to this where it's not like some kind of, certainly this scene in particular doesn't actually feel egregious.
No, I need my anime titty with good character writing.
Well, as we've discussed in other contexts, good character writing makes things hotter.
Yes. And it,
but the whole point is that this scene isn't meant to be, like, yes, this was animated deliberately for a mostly male audience, but it's not...
It doesn't take away from the scene being really poignant.
Right.
It doesn't cut into it at all because we've just seen Noriko hold her sort of original cheerful demeanor together through this weird high school graduation.
Yeah.
This really difficult conversation with Kimiko. But this is the first time in this episode that we see how lonely her life is on Earth.
Kimiko's loneliness, Noriko's loneliness is a recurring theme in this episode, more so than in any episode prior. And it really stuck out to me on this viewing. Another brief aside, there are a bunch of lovely design flourishes in this episode. And one of them is the little, like, clock radio TV thing that she's listening to the news on, and she hears via this broadcast that the top squadron that she was a part of has been disbanded, which is kind of interesting. Like, they're restructuring the military, and the whole thing that she was training to be a part of and served in, and that Smith died in, and all of that, it's just been kind of quietly disbanded. That program is over.
It's a group that she was didn't really feel like she fit into for most of it anyway.
No.
And she comes back to Earth and she can't fit into where she was when she was a normal high school student. She really has nobody. It's very heartbreaking.
It's a rough episode for Noriko, despite a lot of the pathos not really explicitly being about her.
Also, read the clock radio TV. Despite being very sad, this episode is also super, like a Tumblr about, like, 80s anime objects.
Definitely.
Like, rotary phones,
yes,
and TVs,
yes,
and slow shots of, like, an ashtray,
yes,
and it's a very quiet episode.
Well,
the music when it
the happens, first half of it is very quiet.
When the music happens, it's very good, but a lot of the rest of it is just super quiet, and we get that good cicada shit. It's summer in Japan, baby.
Although summer in Okinawa is very different than summer in the rest of Japan.
You would know.
Well, I wouldn't. I've never been there. I've only been on Honshu, actually. But anyhow. And then we move to a scene with Amano and Coach.
No, I think we have some bureaucracy shit first.
Do we? I might not have taken any notes.
We have a couple things first.
Okay.
So I'm gonna, I don't know, like, drink when Molly talks about Ava. There's a bunch of timestamps in this episode. I think they start.
A bunch of timestamps and location, like.
They start at the beginning with the graduation ceremony, captions. But, like, they start in earnest. I think in Noriko's room, it says the date. And the, yeah, if you've ever watched Ava, it's a lot like that. Just this sort of like bold impact. Like you can almost hear the date and location like slapping onto the screen.
Right.
And we cut to this meeting that's happening in, no, I think we're still in Okinawa. We're not in Tokyo yet, but it's the military higher-ups, including the commander of the Excelion, but also a bunch of dudes we've never seen before. And I thought that the meeting in the last episode reminded me of Shin Godzilla, but this one was super duper.
Oh, this one is Shin much Godzilla. More Shin Godzilla, definitely. Yeah.
It's more convoluted.
And it's more like a bunch of people around a table in a room.
There is like a not, shot of an ashtray full of cigarettes.
It's not. So like the Sele meetings are very kind of dramatically lit. Lots of stark backlighting, but sort of dark interiors and shadowy figures making ominous pronouncements. This meeting is not like that. It's like just a random shitty bureaucratic meeting room filled kind of to overflowing with a bunch of people around kind of a ring of tables, but like dudes and aides de camp standing behind them. And they're all sort of processing the new intelligence on the space monsters. And it's very kind of mundane, and you can kind of feel how stuffy the room is.
And the commander of the Excelion is, you get the sense that he's not the top brass in this room. He's kind of become another guy. Like, his opinion matters, but he's not.
He's an admiral. Like, his opinion definitely matters.
It matters, but he's not leading the meeting. He's not, like, heading up the operation, really. Mm-hmm. Then we have one more scene. No. You're right. About which comes next.
Then we see Amano confronting Coach again about something. Only this time.
It's also different, though.
Only this time, we don't know what she's confronting him about. And in fact, we overhear part of their conversation, but then, like, the audio kind of cuts out. And we see them arguing, but we can't hear what they're talking about. But it seems to be kind of more personal.
And this is, like, Noriko is on her way to the room that they're in.
Yeah.
And so she sees part of it, but this is the first time where the three of them have been in one of these scenes where she doesn't just straight up overhear the conversation, yeah. But she sees Coach haul off and slap Amano.
Yep, just right across the face.
And then Amano runs out of the room crying, and this is the first time that Noriko has ever seen Amano cry.
That's a good point.
Which is obviously a huge deal for this character.
Yeah.
And Noriko is hanging back, very confused, when she sees Coach, who also in this scene is not wearing his sunglasses.
Yes.
This is one of the most open scenes. Yeah. He's had his scar out. And from the other end of the room, Noriko sees him collapse.
Yeah, he like collapses in a coughing fit.
Like a blood coughing.
Yeah, fit. And she goes over to him and he's like coughing up blood.
He has space tuberculosis.
And he says, you know, don't tell Amano about this. Like, she's weak. She won't be able to focus on fighting if she knows that I'm sick.
And, you know, nobody in the show in any context has called Amano weak.
Yeah. And he just straight up says it. Like, the translation is very little. Like, Amano wa yoi. She's weak.
And he hints at that humanity is about to face the worst threat yet.
Yeah.
Even after the battle in episode 4, which was pretty bad. Something's coming. You're the only one that can stop it. And this is the first time.
Right, like the Buster Machine is the only thing that can stop it.
We heard in episode 2, Coach said to the commander of the Excelion, like, Amano and Takaya are candidates for the Gunbuster. But since then, we haven't really heard it talked about as a team thing.
Yeah.
This is the first time that's been talked about in any explicit detail. And it's very, I don't know, like, it's very touching too, because it's, a, I don't know, it's a pretty shonen-y hype speech. It's like, I chose you and Amino, like, you're the only ones that can do it, and you have to do it together.
Yeah.
And he says, you have to protect Amino.
Right.
Which is a very different role than Noriko's ever had. I guess she accidentally did it in the last episode. She's never been charged with having any sort of logistical or emotional seniority in that relationship.
Right.
And Coach also hints at, like, you know, I don't really have much time left.
Right.
And he also tells Noriko that he, his plan when she was a child was to protect her father with his life, and he failed to. So he imbues the conversation with that. Like, so now you have to protect all of humanity. And then we're back on the beach with Young Freud.
Just, and who is just like straight up topless.
See, I don't have a problem with the Gunbuster uniforms, but the biggest plot hole in Gunbuster is that they should have weird tan lines. I don't know.
Well, but they're not outside in those
they
uniforms.
They were in high school.
Much.
They were jump roping in the sun.
Oh,
someone
I guess
should
you're
have
right.
Weird diamond tan,
like
lines
weird, like stripes on their on their hips. Yeah.
This is a cute scene, though. I mean, for one, it's cute because it's like, of everyone from the Excelion, like, Amino and Young Freud had kind of a close relationship, but it's Noriko and Young Freud
that are hanging out. Yeah.
And it's a good reminder that there is one other person.
Yes.
That understands what they're going through.
She's in the same situation. She's roughly their age. She's also missed 10 years of time on Earth.
But she's back to her, like, bath scene kind of bravado cheeriness.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, I'm going to pursue another relationship. I've given up on your coach.
Yeah.
And then she says like four versions of YOLO in a row.
Okay.
She says, well, this is just some Ava shit. Two people can't live the same life. That's not a YOLO.
Sure. But it's YOLO adjacent.
Then she says, after all, like, a meeting is the beginning of a goodbye.
Okay.
I didn't catch the whole line in Japanese, but it was like dei for meeting and sayonara for a goodbye.
Okay.
And what she's saying is really sad. Like, she's just saying it in her
blasé Young Freud way.
Yeah, but I don't know, like, you get the sense that she's dealing with her own version of, like, I don't have anyone to be close to.
Yeah.
And having all these traumatic military experiences, maybe she doesn't feel comfortable getting close to people. She doesn't see the point of establishing long-term relationships.
Sure.
You know, she also, even though we didn't know anything about Linda, she lost a friend in the last episode. Like, and it's back to, like, the scene with Coach and the scene with Young Freud are both really, like, reflect on your own mortality scenes.
Yes.
Just in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to mention that in the scene where Coach is talking to Noriko, there's, like, a weird slow jazz version of the battle scene.
Yeah, there is kind of a slow brass remix of the Gunbuster battle theme in that scene.
Then we have a bureaucracy cut to Tokyo, like, explicitly Tokyo.
Yes, the imperial city of Tokyo, which was kind of a strange, and, like, the kanji backed that up, but it was, I don't quite know what it's getting at, but it was another little twit, sort of like tweak of the inherent Japanese-ness of this whole deal with all of the go boards and tatami rooms and etc. Go on.
Tatami's room. Sorry, I can't. I don't want to be... I can't fuck up Japanese for the sake of a bad plurality joke.
Go on.
You might have to explain the details of the procedure, but they're having a detailed meeting about how to stop the upcoming wave of space monsters.
So there's a vast wave of space monsters coming to attack Earth. So large that they blot out most of the sky in from the perspective of the outpost that has detected them. And they're discussing what they can do, and they don't come up with very much. And then like coach like bursts into the room where they're having this meeting, and he's like, you know, wearing his yukata, and it's like mostly disheveled, and he's being held back by people, and he says, I have a proposal.
He came from his go room.
Yes, he came from his
as a go room in every location.
And his proposal is to essentially use the now decommissioned Excelion's degeneracy reactor to blow it up and create an artificial black hole and a gigantic detonation in the center of this cloud of space monsters that will annihilate most or all of them. The Buster units, the two, we are informed, Buster units piloted by Amano and Noriko, will escort the Excelion out there and protect it until it gets to where it needs to be, and then they'll blow it up. And that's what Coach says they should do.
And the rest of the meeting is just like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, they're like, all right. So it's not clear like why they were trying to keep him out of that meeting or why nobody else thought that was a good idea. Lots of interesting details, like we'll take it out past Jupiter too. Which is it has its own name. It's Daiyōsen, which is like a planet name. Like patterned off of other planet names in names for actual planets in Japanese, but it isn't actually a real planet. I can only assume that somehow in the localization or translation of this, like Jupiter 2 was given as the canonical translation for Daiyōsen, because I can't see any other reason why you would imagine why you would come up with Jupiter 2 as a translation for Daiyōsen. Mm-hmm. If I, as a translator, encountered that, I would probably try to find another like Roman god to name it after. But it's like some, you know, big planetoid, like in the, you know, far reaches of solar orbit. And in general, the scale, the distances and scale of this episode are kind of muddled.
Yeah.
Which is like, who cares? I definitely don't care.
Because then Noriko and Amano hop on the JR.
Oh, I'm talking about in space.
I feel like also in...
No, not at all. That's very clear. They hop on the future Shinkansen on JR, which is in a bullet train in a vacuum tube, which takes them from Okinawa to Osaka in like an hour. Notably, that trip takes much longer than that now, and also you can't make it by train because Okinawa is like 100 miles south of the rest of Japan, like across ocean. So probably longer than that. I don't actually know. You have to fly there now is the point. But now they have a vacuum tube train that goes much faster, and they get to Osaka in...
I'm forgetting that they take two trains. There's like the Shinkansen and the subway.
And then there's the local train, which is like this weird, like hanging. So I love the design for the Shinkansen because it looks very futuristic. But the interior of it is like just looks like the Shinkansen. Yeah. And
they come with a snack cart.
They come with a snack cart, and the lady driving by like is announcing what's on the snack cart in exactly the voice that those ladies use on the real Shinkansen.
I kind of regret that I've never bought a snack on the Shinkansen.
We're just gonna have to do that.
I bought snacks at like I'm sorry the Shinkansen station bodega before. I got those little, if you ever want to try Japanese snacks, I'm really partial to those little chocolate Mount Fuji snacks.
Oh, God.
It's like chocolate strawberry.
I can't remember what they're called.
But like the snow on top of Mount Fuji is like strawberry.
Mm.
So that's another.
The reason you don't
that's
buy.
That's another unspawned spawn con.
The reason you don't buy snacks on the Shinkansen is that they are much more expensive.
It's too much pressure. Like, I can't make that decision in such a short period of time.
Yeah, you have to be very confident in the fact that you won't get yelled at.
I can't make that decision in the United States,
sure,
where people are going to yell at me,
yeah,
like on a plane. I definitely can't make that decision in Japan, where it's like, I know that I'm inconveniencing you and that actually matters.
But you're not.
But we all have to pretend that nobody's inconveniencing.
But you're not.
Like,
You're not inconveniencing the person who, like, they are walking a cart down the middle of the aisle and saying, you can buy some of these snacks if you want them. And you saying, excuse me, may I peruse your wares? And then buying one of the snacks. That's not inconveniencing
them. Being a Meiwaku.
You're not being a Meiwaku. Well, it's very, Meiwaku means trouble or obstacle. Problem in Japanese. You're not. Anyway, so then they get to they take the Neo Shinkansen to Osaka, or maybe Tokyo, I'm not
to,
sure.
To Neo Yokio.
And then they take this like hanging tram thing, like it's like a subway, but it's suspended instead of riding on top of tracks. It's great. It's yet another one of the wonderful design flourishes of this episode.
But it looks like a normal subway inside.
Yes,
and has like some instant coffee ads in the back.
That's great.
Also, they're wearing their like school uniforms,
uh-huh,
this whole time. And I think it's cute that Noriko still wears her uniform with, like, the scrunchy white socks.
Hmm.
Which is a very, very, like, Japanese high school girl style that's associated with youthfulness. And she also has a little charm on her school bag. Whereas Amano has, like, a sophisticated train case and is wearing sensible pumps.
So I have a question for you.
For me?
Yes. But I have not posed yet. But it occurred to me midway through this episode, and I knew that I had to bring it up. Is Amano a bow girl?
I think that she was when she was a child.
Mm.
Definitely. And maybe had to get sort of the fancifulness, at least outwardly, stamped out of her.
Right.
But I definitely think so.
Because I think she has bow girl energy.
She does have bow girl energy. And also, if she comes from a wealthy background, which we have every reason to believe that she does.
Yes.
You know, she went on vacances in space.
Yes.
So, which, like, even though this is 2020 when she started high school.
Yeah.
It's very, like, her whole demeanor is so, like, Taisho,
it's
high class.
It's very Taisho era. She's
that you would be.
Yeah.
She would have read Anne of Green Gables and Little Women.
Yes.
As a child.
Absolutely.
Like, that would have been like I feel like an essential reading for like a girl of good breeding.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like she probably did read those and want to get a little rowdy. And might have been a really imaginative child, but by the time she got to high school, she zipped it up a bit.
Right. Also,
I do love that she has...
Also, you're going to need to explain what a bow girl is.
So, I have to credit, there's a writer in New York that I'm a fan of. She writes for The New Yorker, The New York Times. She has a very good perfume newsletter. Her name is Rachel Syme. And one day she had a Twitter thread about bow girls. Which, like, so all of you have probably heard, like, horse girl.
Yes.
We all know what a horse girl is. Bow girl is, like, you read, like, Little House on the Prairie, Little Women, Anne of Green Gables, you wore, like, some of you, hopefully, I don't know if anyone's listening to this, like, many, many little girls with long hair, like, we get slapped with just these giant fucking bows in our hair. Like, a bow girl would be a girl that chooses to keep wearing them. And it's, there's sort of like a, there's often like a baby anglophilia.
Yeah.
To it, where like, you're a really imaginative child, but you want to be refined.
Yes.
And like, you probably force all of your friends to have a tea party.
Right. Which of the American girls is the bow girl?
Samantha.
Okay.
Samantha is a rich girl in the Industrial Revolution. And she's also like, yeah, she's like too more imaginative than her family wants her to be.
I see.
I have a lot of bow girl tendencies.
Yeah.
But I was not allowed to have long hair until a little bit later in childhood.
Weirdly, not being allowed to have long hair during a time when you wanted to is very bow girl.
I still remember the day when I got made fun of in like kindergarten or first grade for being the only girl in the class without long hair.
Wow.
And it wasn't my choice and it drove me nuts.
Yeah.
But I do think it's cute how even though most of the show takes place in a military context and people have uniforms.
Right.
But they all of the main characters have signature flourishes.
Mm-hmm.
And for Amino, it's her giant yellow bow that she keeps her hair up in. For young Freud, even in battle, she wears like big pearl earrings.
Oh, I hadn't noticed that.
I mean, she has her cross necklace under her uniform, but like even when she's dressed identically, she has big pearl earrings. And Noriko has Smith's headband.
Yes.
That she always wears.
All right. I just wanted to get the bow girl question handled.
I mean, I think it's really important because we've talked a lot, especially in the first episode, about how this show basically starts as a shoujo school life show.
Yeah.
And that literary tradition in Japan really draws on like Little Women and Anne of Green Gables.
So sure.
You have to take it all as a whole.
I mean, I felt very clever and funny and online for asking, is Amino a bow girl? But I also realized, oh, shit, no, I think this is actually a relevant through line.
No, it is.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not by accident that the camera lingers on, like, Noriko's duffel bag.
Yeah.
That has a little octopus charm on it.
Sure.
Like, I think they want us to realize that she still has all these teenager signifiers.
Yeah.
And then they gotta go on the mission.
They get into their buster machines, and there are two of them. There are two, and they're not mecha. They're not robots. They're not little. They're big planes.
They're littler than the Excelion.
They're big spaceships. Big kind of rocket ships. One looks Amino's looks a little more like a SR-71 kind of plane, and Noriko's looks kind of just like a 50s rocket ship looking thing.
Sure, I know exactly what an SR-71.
Well, Molly, the SR-71 Blackbird was the backbone of United States aerial surveillance in the 60s through the 90s. It was a spy plane that flew higher and faster than any other aircraft that any government officially acknowledges existing. Mm-hmm. And it was the bane of the Soviets. They literally couldn't make a missile fast enough to hit it.
So when young Freud shows up to wish them goodbye, she's like, wait a minute.
Yeah, probably not. It doesn't look that much like an SR-71.
But they strap into their mechs and...
Not mechs, they're airplanes.
They're airplanes.
They're spaceships.
I'm just thinking of them as the guns buster. Silas made Paul spit out his whiskey.
Go on.
And Noriko has got her kind of like dumbass personality back on.
Yeah, she's just like being a goof.
Because also, part of this mission is that if they complete it successfully and they come back, 6 months will have passed on Earth.
Yeah, so there's more time dilation problems.
And Noriko knows that Coach is grievously ill.
Right.
But she's been told, you know, not to tell Amino this. And so she straps in, gets Amino on the video feed and is like, oh, like, you guys would make such a perfect couple. Like, I bet when you get back, you guys should just get married. Like, I've figured it out, haven't I? And she's being a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
And Amino is kind of silently heartbroken. And you realize, like, Amino totally knows everything.
Yeah, she knows that Coach is sick. Like, she knows.
And she says, you know, we may never see them again.
We're going to be gone for 6 months, and there's no reason to think that he's going to live that long.
And they take off, and Coach and Young Freud were actually watching them launch. And then Young Freud says, we may never see them again.
Yeah.
So it goes both ways.
Right. And from then on, it's pretty much the battle goes almost precisely according to plan.
With a couple interesting character things.
Oh, no. I'm not trying to skim over it. I'm just saying, like, the plan as described is weirdly...
Yeah, it's a kitsch list.
Almost exactly what happens.
At first, it seems like Coach was wrong, because Coach says, you know, if Amino knows, she won't be able to fight.
Right.
But when they actually start the operation, Amino's pretty...
She seems pretty fine. In the zone.
But they... So, in their spacecrafts, they have clocks that on the top show Earth time and on the bottom show the time that has elapsed for them.
Yeah.
And so both of them in the back of their mind have 6 months and are we too late?
Yeah.
And when they... Is warp the right word?
It's not warp. It's just relativistic. Warp is like teleportation or like going into subspace. They don't do that. They're just, you know.
When they zoom.
They're just zooming at relativistic speeds.
When they bucket to Jupiter 2.
Yeah.
Like. And they start the battle and the clock really starts flying. That's when Amino cracks.
Like, she just sees like days flying by on that bottom clock, and just, she can't take it.
And we've never seen her have a breakdown.
Right.
Especially not in the heat of battle.
Yeah.
And she's crying. She's saying she can't do it. She tells Noriko what we all kind of already know at this point.
Yeah.
She says, you know, I've never told him I loved him. I've never told him anything.
Yeah.
Back in that last conversation we had, I wanted him to tell him that he loved me. And he didn't, and
yeah.
I'm never going to see him again. And she's, she's sort of taken on, like, Noriko's role in the first half of the series of being the one that loses her shit.
Well, we just get the sense that she's, it makes it so clear that she's, the margin by which she's been holding her shit together for all this time, through all this stuff, is much narrower than... it has appeared from the exterior, because she's so good at maintaining that exterior.
And we're not given any information about her family. As we saw in episode one, she didn't really have friends in high school. So she's in the same position as Noriko and to some degree Young Freud.
Yeah.
They come back to Earth and are completely isolated. So for Amino, her relationship with Coach is like her personal reason to live, basically.
Yeah.
And Noriko is the one that has to give her a pep talk and tell her to snap out of it.
Yeah.
And what she says is basically like, Coach is spending his 6 months wishing he was with you, and like his spirit has made this mission possible and made the Gunbuster possible, and you're not just fighting to get back to him, you're fighting for the future of all mankind.
Right.
Sorry, I'm having a chronology thing clicking in my head.
Yeah.
But this the other scene with Kimiko, does that happen in the middle of this battle or after the battle?
Which is the scene with Kimiko?
Where she's talking to her daughter.
I don't remember.
So I'm pretty sure at some point, like mid-battle,
right,
it cuts to Kimiko is holding her daughter, looking out the window, and says, like...
No, it says they're launching, because Kimiko is watching two Buster machines rise into the sky. And she has a conversation with her daughter. Go on.
Yeah, she says, there are two things that I forgot to mention about the launch. Kimiko, despite this 10-year time dilation difference, says that's Mama's very best friend in the world, Noriko. Mm-hmm. And I almost started crying at that point.
Yeah.
And also, as they're launching, this is when Noriko ties Smith's headband on.
Oh, again. Yes.
But once Noriko talks some sense into Ama. Oh, also in this, she calls her Kazumi for the first.
Oh, time. Interesting.
First and only time?
Maybe, definitely, yeah.
First time. And it's towards the end of the talk, and I feel like it had an effect on her.
Yeah.
And I have this GIF saved on my computer when Amino focuses again. Mm-hmm. She has this amazing like look on her face where she kind of raises one eyebrow.
Yeah.
And it's just like, let's do it.
Yeah. And then they gattai. Gattai, Japanese word for combination. Specifically, in this case, when two spaceships join to become one extremely large robot.
When two spaceships love each other very
much. I was deliberately not making that joke.
Sorry.
It's fine. and it's a really, it's a great, like, mech combining sequence. It's got lots of great mechanisms. It's fantastic. And we see these two spaceships reconfigure themselves to become the Gunbuster that we saw in the last episode.
Which is also, like, God, like, how was Noriko doing that by herself?
Oh, how was she piloting the thing at all by herself? Yeah, unclear. I mean, maybe that's part of why she... Maybe didn't actually do very well.
Yeah, and is part it of like, why it's amazing, too.
Yeah, that she managed to do it at all, but yes. Yeah, so, Kazumi, Amano has her own cockpit, which is very different than Noriko's. It's, like, very, like, she's surrounded by instruments and so on, as opposed to Noriko, who's, like, in the big display sphere.
Like, Amano's, like, the brain, and Noriko's, like, the soul.
Yeah, kind of. And then they sort of turn the tide on the aliens, and they're...
Noriko's Gunbuster Damachi.
Yes.
There
are many cool Buster attacks of various kinds. You got your Buster Collider, your Buster Missiles, your Super Inazuma Kick.
I mean, that's an incredible part.
It's extremely... It's all great. Like, the battle... The problem is there's not much to say about it in terms of incisive character stuff. It's just like a thrilling space battle with lots of great visual flourishes.
Right before the battle starts, there is a shot that made me very sad, which is like they're carting sort of like the Excellion carcass that they're gonna blow up.
Yeah,
but there's this shot of like space monsters infiltrating it.
Oh, like and getting it, inside of it.
Yeah, and just, yeah. Like these rooms that we came to know.
Yeah,
like. Were full of life.
I will say something that jumped out to me about this battle. It's paced very strangely. Like, they get to the... They arrive in the midst of this enemy swarm, and they're just kind of among these, you know, millions and millions of giant space of like giant space monsters, many of which seem to be paying them no mind whatsoever.
Yeah,
and it
they
feels
still have room to have a talk.
Well, it feels. I can't remember if this is a line from Gunbuster or from the Diebuster, the sequel, but it feels weirdly like cellular. Like, because at one point someone makes the comparison of like the space monsters are just like the immune system of the galaxy and we're just germs. And it kind of feels like
nature is healing. We are the virus.
Yes. It kind of feels like these are not, despite their like appalling destructive power and potency, there's not a mind behind this. This is not a clash of civilizations. This is like a natural phenomenon that they're like, you know, gigantic white blood cells that only react when you sort of get close or when certain conditions are triggered. And it feels very uncanny in that way.
It's sort of another facet of the space monsters being like a really scary enemy throughout the whole show, because they take really different roles. Like, these are not what we've seen in the earlier episodes, which are these terrifying, like, powerful blurs that zip by and are so powerful that you can't land.
Yeah, and we also see a whole bunch of different, like, new shapes of monsters in this episode.
It's, again, like, I think you nailed it when you called them fungal.
Yeah.
Also,
yes,
when the battle gets lit,
yes,
the music gets lit.
Yes, yes. When they combine, there's like a whole, there's a new song we haven't heard before.
I have this song.
And it slaps, and it's great.
I can't remember what it's
called. But so, the upshot is, they combine, the United Gunbuster holds off the aliens, the space monsters, until the Excelion can get to where it needs to be. Explodes in a beautifully animated, like, black hole explosion.
In utter silence.
Yes, which is really eerie and great, and annihilates the bulk of the alien fleet. And Noriko and Kazumi are able to essentially return home as planned.
Wait, quick shout out to Buster Shield.
Oh, yes.
Which is
one of the devices that the Gunbuster deploys is the Buster Shield, which is just a big cape. It just whips out a big cape from nowhere and like shrouds itself.
It's
like
very, like Phantom,
like,
of the,
like,
Opera.
Dracula style, just like whoosh, and then like deflects a bunch of lasers. It's great.
The other thing that I love about this battle is,
yes,
that, like, just some great, like, Noriko guttural scream.
Oh, she does a lot of hollering.
She's one of the best characters I've seen in mecha anime as far as, like, making noise. Like, I feel like people actually would in a battle. I don't know. Like, it's very...
It's very great.
Very good voice acting.
It's very visceral.
But no, then they come home.
Then they come home.
And they just kind of float down.
They just drive the Gunbuster, which, recall, is like skyscraper scale. It's like Godzilla scale. It is large.
So I don't know how it was like stored in the Excelion. And
they just drive it to the hospital where Coach is staying.
Get in, loser. We're going shopping.
And then,
oh, and then the Gunbuster, they delicately lower its
hand, and then a little door in the side of its thumb pops open, and they like walk out. It's great.
Well, they kind of like fall over themselves running out.
Yes.
And they run and burst into Coach's hospital room where he is still alive.
He's still alive.
And he's playing Go with himself.
And he's playing Go with a little like portable magnetic Go board in his like lap.
And Amino just throws herself on him.
Just fucks up his Go game utterly. Just like does not give a shit.
Tells him she loves him.
Yeah.
And then I started crying a lot.
Then you did. But the moment that stuck out to me as being really sad,
Noriko,
is that this is a joyous moment of reuniting for Amino. But then we see Noriko kind of standing outside the hospital room and realizing, you know, she should give them some space. And she has a sort of, she pauses there for a moment. And it's just long enough for us to realize, oh, she doesn't have anybody.
She also is. Well, she's like choking. She's silencing her tears.
Right. I mean, she's overwhelmed by the emotion of the moment, but it's not the same emotion that Amino is feeling. Like, she's clearly both deeply happy for her friend, but her isolation from them and the fact that them coming closer necessarily excludes her.
Especially since Amino is sort of like the most important person in her life.
Right.
But Noriko's not the most important person in Amino's life.
Yes.
Also, Amino calls him Koichiro for the first time.
Yeah, she calls him Koichiro-san, which is a very like married couple thing to call him.
I'm a sucker for the like uses first name the first time thing. And that happens twice in this episode.
Yeah.
But yeah, then we have the shot of Noriko standing sort of silhouetted in the sunset against the gunbuster. Talking to herself. She's saying, you know, I'm sorry, Smith. Are you proud of me, Papa?
Yeah.
And yeah, it is really heartbreaking.
She doesn't have anyone.
And she doesn't know that Kimiko called her best friend in the world.
But even so, like, what would it matter? Like, yeah. There's now a gap between them that can never really be bridged. Noriko is lonely in a way that feels permanent.
Yeah.
And it's rough. And then the episode ends. That's it.
Yeah, it's really gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I've always loved Amino a ton. Like, she's one of my favorite female characters in anime. And I like Noriko, but the first time I watched this show, her character didn't stick with me
sure.
as much. And like this time I'm realizing just what an incredible character and what a sad character she is.
Yeah. It's a good show, man.
I don't know. Yeah, this is probably my favorite episode. Like this in my YouTube favorites, I have some like half rough cut video
mm-hmm.
of the scene where they land and Amino rushes into the hospital. That's one of my videos where I'm like, if I need to make myself cry, I'm gonna watch this video. So I love that. And that's what's always stuck out in my mind is like the reason that I love this episode. But now, I don't know, there are a lot of reasons to love this episode. There are a lot of really incredible moments and
yeah,
some of the best character writing in the whole show.
Definitely.
This episode. I might actually cry on air next time. We both might. I don't know.
I mean, I famously cry whenever I try to describe the ending of Gunbuster to someone who I don't think is ever actually going to watch it, so I can just tell them.
That's the mark of that's a commonality.
Yeah. We'll see.
thanks for making it this far.